So how long have you been in New York for this trip?
Oh, just 3-4 days. I was in Toronto. Wonderful thing called the Toronto International Author Festival, which nobody in the United States appears to have heard of.
No, I haven't, in fact. Tell me about it.
It's an amazing thing. Apparently it can only really happen in Toronto, because you know the business district downtown.
Have you been to Toronto? I have not been to... I've been to Montreal. I have not been to Toronto.
But Toronto, I mean, it's a very condensed city, and the business district is about this wide, and it's all located with all these company corporation presidents sitting in towers so close to each other that they can actually see other corporation presidents out of the window dictating memos. Consequently, a great deal of paranoid corporation money goes into funding 50 writers whom nobody's ever heard of from Japan and Holland and England and Germany and God knows where to go and stay at the Hilton and have a ball for a fortnight in Toronto. Oh, God, everybody was there. William Golding, James Baldwin, Ken Kesey.
Wow.
It was great fun.
I wonder if you ran into a young novelist, short story writer no one has ever heard of, Belgian extraction, and he is teaching in Ottawa now. His name is Guy Vanderhaeghe.
I haven't heard of him either.
You have not heard of him. His first two books have been published in America by Fichtner and Fields.
Mm.
He's a wonderful writer and completely unknown. I was delighted to be able to talk to him. And
is Fichtner and Fields a good publisher to launch a young writer? Do they actually have the punch to?
They work very hard with Guy Vanderhaeghe, and indeed had set up what amounted to a nationwide tour of several cities across the country. Fichtner and Fields is a very old publishing house. It was founded in the 19th century in Boston.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought it was a Boston house, not a New
York. It originally was in Boston, and it published many of the great American New England poets.
Well, indeed.
I have
19th century Fichtner and Fields editions of things.
Do you?
Yep. But I don't know anybody now, apart from your Belgian extraction novelist, who I know nobody who's published by Fichtner and Fields.
It's a very small, very small publishing house that had a rebirth about 4 years ago in New Haven.
Mm.
Subsequently, they moved it to New York. It's very small. It is affiliated with Houghton Mifflin. It is kind of a Houghton Mifflin imprint.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
And I think Houghton Mifflin does most of their distribution.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
So it's a small house that is trying to capitalize on an old name. And how good they are for a young writer, I don't know. I don't know how good established publishing houses are for young writers, as far as that
goes.
Well,
I would have thought that, I mean, if you were going to publish your first book now, I mean, you have that much more chance, don't you, if you're published by Simon and Schuster, say, or Random House, or some other company like that. I mean, Viking's problems are well known. I mean, I think Elizabeth Sifton Books is probably the only really healthy part of that house right at this
time. Well, Viking has an extremely good literary reputation. The number of houses that have good literary reputations in the United States are...
Yeah,
you can
but
count one hand.
It was sustained for, the last 15 years by one man who has now left. Alan Williams.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what happens to Viking now?
But I do a lot of Viking writers. I do a lot of Knopf. Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, Knopf, Random House. Knopf is part of Random House. Viking. A substantial number of Simon and Schuster. A lot of Houghton Mifflin. Harcourt, Brace, and Jovanovich.
And Farrar, Straus, presumably.
Yeah, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I think I said that wrong before. These seem to be the best houses.
If
there is a writer who is published by one of those houses, that is a fairly good recommendation right off the bat. It's true that you could have a young writer, Goodwin, published by Fichtner and Fields. It may not carry as much weight as Knopf or Viking, but you never know.
And, of course, they may actually take much more trouble with him than a big house would.
Sometimes. I hear universal complaints from writers about their publishers. Who publishes you in England?
Collins.
They publish James
there is
Jones.
A rare thing that the book is actually dedicated to my publisher, Christopher McElhaze. Not many writers dedicate their books to their publishers.
I have a copy of From Here to Eternity, which was published by Collins. And I also have the American edition when it first came out. Mm. And I noticed that with amusement that Collins felt obliged to clean up the language certain
scenes. Well, of course,
scenes.
Yes. I mean, it was run by, for years and years. I mean, when From Here to Eternity came out, it was run by Billy Collins, whose wife ran the religious list. And then Collins basically print Bibles. I mean, that's what their fortune is founded on.
Well, I guess James Jones offended them somewhat, and but you're talking about the army, and it seemed to me they took more liberties. I'm familiar with you. I think we have something in common.
Good heavens. That's a book I haven't seen for a while.
Yeah, I have a great interest in Robert Lowell. I have all of his stuff, with the exception of one book, which was his first book, Land of Unlikeness.
Which I think was
published in an edition of only 200 copies.
Mm.
And extremely rare, and I have never even seen a copy of it. But I have everything else that I've been collecting for many years and enjoyed a lot.
I was a close friend of his for about, I suppose, the last 7 years of his life. I met him in 1970, I think, as a result of the book review. So I knew him during the sort of last London years well.
How did you get to know him?
I did a review on radio. On the BBC of Lowell's notebook.
Of Lowell's what?
Notebook.
Notebook?
Notebook.
Notebook. Yes.
And I got this postcard came. I thought it was a hoax. It said you'd put me in the best possible company. Can we meet for lunch? Yours sincerely, Robert Lowell. And I thought it was one of my friends playing jokes on me. Mm. Anyway, I gave a pair of telephone numbers. I rang them up rather suspiciously. And there was Lowell on the other end. We had lunch. And we talked rather stiffly about literature for the first half of lunch, and then very enthusiastically about fishing for the second half of lunch. We arranged a fishing trip for the following Saturday. We went fishing together. I ended up living in a flat at the bottom of the Lowell's house in London. They were dividing their time between London and the country. We became fast friends.
What was Lowell like during those last 7 years? I know he was taking...
Lithium.
Lithium, yeah.
Mm. Well, his... I mean, I saw him in... I mean, the real problem with... I'm sorry, I'm going to cut this, because I'm not going to talk about Lowell and lithium as a part of a radio interview. I mean, I think that's a sort of betrayal of a confidence, and I don't want to talk. I mean, sorry.
No, that's all. That's all
right. I don't think it's a legitimate.
Outside of the lithium, what was his like? Was his behavior fairly substantial during that period?
I know intensely,
prior to that time, he had been in and out of the mental hospital quite a bit.
It's not primarily what I remember of Lowell at all. What I remember of Lowell is a man who, in some ways, taught me how to read. I mean, I'd been a university lecturer in literature before I went freelance as a writer. Lowell, I am immensely grateful to for simply his learnedness, his acquaintance with poetry, both English and American. He introduced me to masses of things. His jokes were wonderful. He was a very funny man, and that's something that nobody's been able to capture. It's curious how the Ian Hamilton biography, which came out... I mean, it's very, very accurate about Lowell in a million ways, but what it doesn't get is the intensity of that man's charm and his humour, partly because his jokes were so much matters of tone of voice, that there is almost no way in which you can ever make a Lowell joke, and he was full of jokes, sound as funny when you try to retell it. I mean, they're not stories, they're ironic turns of phrase. And one of the great difficulties in communicating that man is capturing that tone of voice, that humour, that rich. He was the most playful man in the world. He just loved playing with words. It was his work and his life. You couldn't go on a car ride through the English countryside with Lowell without Lowell fueling out these wonderful metaphors which had just come pouring out. I mean, he'd just play and play and play. I mean, he'd see a dried up stream and he'd think it would look like the Somme, and then he'd begin to create the First World War sort of happening in the middle of Kent. And he was funny, and I think it's the humour of the man that gets lost in the biographies. Mr. Count of Lowell are rather solemn, I mean, as if he was the sort of pope of
I know what you're saying.
I mean, the pope in the religious sense, not the pope in the poetic one, not Alexander Pope, but the other one. And what one gets is a picture of a solemn manic depressive. And I remember when Ian Hamilton's book came out in England, it was reviewed in the Sunday Times by a clever and reasonable and decent man called John Carey, whose first sentence of his review read, one's first thought on finishing this book is, what a skunk. Now, I'm afraid the Hamilton biography did an awful lot to establish Lowell's reputation as a skunk, and a skunk he was not. He was a man full of charm, of generosity, of humility, of enormous humour. He was probably the most lively and vivid man I've ever known in my life. And one of the problems is that that vividness is pretty well uncommunicable, except through his poems, I mean, which still stand, and there they are, it's vivid. But his table talk, which was immensely funny and witty, is somehow unreproducible. It happened. One was delighted by it at the time. You go away and try and tell it to somebody else, and it just comes out sounding flat.
I know what you're saying. I have this wonderful record, which was released by Cadmium, of Lowell reading his poetry at the 92nd Street Y. And he, of course, describes the poem and sets up each poem before he reads it. And this humor comes through all the way through, and the audience is tittering.
It didn't bring down the house.
But there was this genuine humor there that sometimes is not always apparent in his poetry, some of which is difficult, but some of which is also very moving. There was one I can always get out of poems. This is usually happens after I have a couple of drinks and I get a little maudlin. But I inevitably, after having two martinis or three, will reach for a poem called Middle Age. And I read that poem. I've read that poem. He makes reference to his father in that poem.
Yes.
And are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I am.
And I tend to get that poem out perhaps every 3 weeks.
Yes.
And I have never yet had a dry eye after reading it.
Yes. He was a word magician.
Couldn't stop playing with his words, though, could he?
No,
Notebook, you mentioned Notebook. There were three editions of Notebook.
I know. For that book which you have in front of you, Robert Lowell's Poems of Selection, I remember Cal and I sitting down. I mean, this was when I had known him for perhaps 6 months, and some academic had wanted to do a selection of his poems, and Cal didn't want that very much. I mean, he said, would you do it instead? I said, sure, thinking that I'd just sort of select the poems that I liked. I made a rough selection out of his poems that I did like. Went to stay with him over the weekend at his country house, Millgate in Kent. And we sat down up in the study, and Lowell started rewriting every single poem, even the early ones. I mean, the poems out of the Mills of the Caverners. He'd say, I don't think that line works. And it was a miserable time for me. The poems kept, even poems written in 1947 were being rewritten for that edition in 1972, 73, I can't remember the date on the book. And he was endlessly revising and re-revising. There's a poem in Notebook, actually, where he says something like, we sit about revising our revisions, talking about himself and his wife. I remember Cal once saying, oh, revising is so much more fun than writing poetry. And he was an obsessive reviser. It's a great problem. I mean, for the scholars, and I am no scholar and never was, but for the scholars it's a very serious problem, because there are about 16 different versions of every Robert Lowell poem, because he couldn't, even at a reading, look at a poem that he'd written 20 years before without actually rewriting it in the course of reading it. He loved revision. He loved playing.
I was also amused. I had never heard his voice. I, fortunately, had never met him. And I was amused to hear in this reading, and I play this record quite often, but his accent is a strange one for someone who was born in New England. It sounds, in fact, almost Southern.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he went to Kenyon to study under, particularly Randall Jarrell and Alan Tate, and his roommate was Peter Taylor from Tennessee. In fact, I saw Peter last week at the Toronto International Author Festival. We were talking about the Ian Hamilton book, And I said to Peter that, I felt that the book missed out an awful lot. And Peter said, oh yeah, Cal was so funny. And I can't do the southern accent. I mean, I shouldn't be sitting here in a New York studio imitating American accents. But in fact, there is a great, great deal of Peter Taylor's Tennessee, Charlottesville, Virginia voice in Lowell's voice. Mm-hmm. And Lowell was this sort of runaway from New England who apprenticed himself to the South at the height of the New Criticism. He wanted to talk like Robert Penn Warren, really.
A conscious effort to adopt another type of dialect.
Well, I think what he saw was this sort of rival aristocracy, really. It was the aristocracy. It was an intellectual aristocracy. I mean, he came from, I don't know, I suppose you could, of course the Lowells are an intellectual family, but I think there was an awful lot in that hard, rigid, rather middle-class kind of Boston aristocracy that Cal didn't like. And when he went to the South, what he saw there was a sort of intellectual aristocracy of a living kind. And I think he adored, I mean, people like Penn Warren, Tate, Alan Tate particularly, his roommate Peter Taylor, his teacher Randall Jarrell, and somehow the whole of the New Criticism, and that very exciting movement in American letters was being conducted in a Southern accent. So Lowell's voice was a peculiar mixture of that sort of Anglophile Boston voice and also the voice of Tennessee somehow, and the two voices get mixed up.
Well, Jonathan, we're going to talk about you. As soon as I started reading Foreign Land, I liked the voice that you created, and I was delighted that you were going to be in town, and I called Viking and asked if it'd be possible that I could talk to you and talk about you and your work. Tell me a few facts about your own life and your background. You established a couple of times so far that, no, you're not an academic, so, but you certainly have an academic demeanor in many respects. Well, tell me about your background.
You say an academic demeanor. I grew up in a succession of vicarages and parsonages, and I come from one of those faded middle-class English families that did virtuous service in places like India in the 19th century and sank to nothing during the 20th, and were left with faded ancestral portraits and coats of arms sort of earned 150 years before for some financial piece of shop practice or other by some ancestor or other. And growing up in a parsonage was curious, because a parsonage in England is a social island. You are not the gentry, that's for sure. But nevertheless, you have sort of gentry ancestors on the walls. You're not the working class, that's for sure, too, though you have a working class salary, certainly a vicar's stipend in England. When I was growing up in the 1950s, it was about £500 a year, which was about the same as, semi-skilled labourers. My family was totally peripatetic. We moved about. I was born in Norfolk. We crossed over to the west side of the country to live on Merseyside. We came down south to live in Sussex, then crossed over to Hampshire. I went to school in Worcester. I went to university in Hull up in the northeast. So we kept on zigzagging, or I kept on zigzagging around the country. But always coming from this... It's always hard, I think, to explain to an American audience just how much those English vices of snobbery and deference, of class, are still important. And I think England, even now, is a country eaten up by class.
I've read Paul Theroux.
Well, I don't know that Paul Theroux is the world's greatest expert on class.
Paul Theroux said something very interesting, just exactly in line with what you have said. One of the reasons, he says, that many Britishers are so distant with one another and with strangers is that they are afraid to open their mouths for fear of revealing their accents.
I think that's very true. And it's a very, very, very powerful thing. If you grow up, particularly in the English countryside, you are constantly trying to locate yourself. Where do you belong? And I think growing up in a vicarage family was, for me, a marvelous preparation for becoming a writer, because it established a sort of social solitude and outsiderness. You were both, as it were, at the center of the community, because there was your father running the church. And the church in the 1950s in England, in a village, assumed some claim, however specious, to being the center of things. You know, I mean, at least it ran the whist rides and stuff like that. And one's father, my father, was on a hotline to God Almighty himself. So this seemed a pretty powerful position to occupy. And yet we were absolutely islanded between classes. We were neither fish nor flesh nor fowl nor good red herring. So it established a kind of social isolation and a sense of continuous anomalousness to the point where I think it made one rather a sharp observer of things. One had an entree. I mean, actually the church in the 1950s was a little like a failed colonial institution, rather like England itself. My father would go around trawling for souls in the village, in the village. He'd go up to the big houses at one end, he'd go into the council estate, I suppose what you would hear call a housing project.
That's a wonderful line, trawling for souls.
And anyway, he'd make these sort of imperialist forays on God's behalf into distant areas of the village. And the moment my father began to establish a colony somewhere, the vicarage family, of course, would follow in his wake. So we'd go on tiptoe with our heads bowed into the great houses and armed with the awful rituals of class condescension into, as it were, the housing projects, so that one learned how to dissimulate and also to observe. I mean, one became a tremendous kind of collector of class detail and nuance and the different ways in which people lived. And looking back on it, I suppose I had a much more socially mobile childhood than most people have, simply because I was going into different kinds of houses all the time and seeing people and always feeling an outsider there myself, so I never felt I belonged anywhere. And it does seem to me that if there's any kind of continuous theme that runs through my own books now, it is the theme of homelessness and the inability of people to find a place for themselves in whatever world they are. I suppose it's what drew me to the travel book, because the travel book is essentially, its real theme is homelessness, of searching for a home. And I think that's probably what obsesses me too in the novel Foreign Land.
Were you bookish?
Oh, frankly bookish, yes. I mean, I was a, I mean, in England, we're called wets.
Wets?
Wets, yes. You know, we're sickly, we have asthma, we can't play games. You know, we're the last kid to be picked on the team for anything. And books were a very early refuge. I mean, if I couldn't become useful at anything else, at least I could be able in words, not as an articulate person at all. I was never one of those kids who were clever at making jokes at school. My wit was always sort of retrospective and slow, and it took pen and paper and hours of thought to be able to develop, you know, the smart answer that I should have made 5 hours before. I think an awful lot of writing actually proceeds out of that sense of inarticulateness in the world, where you go and rewrite it in your head afterwards. The French call it l'esprit d'escalier, you know, the thought that strikes you on the staircase when you leave the room, the remark that you should have made. And writing, I suppose, is really an extension of l'esprit d'escalier. It is having the leisure to be able to sit down in a room and work for a whole day on the sentence that more articulate people than oneself might manage to have just make up and toss away and forget about.
At the university, you studied English.
I did.
What happened when you graduated?
Well, I wanted to be an actor. I played sort of the usual university part. In other words, when you're at university in the drama society, you spend most of your time playing either Hamlet or Othello or Othello or Hamlet. In other words, good parts. I joined the professional theatre and discovered a few hard truths about myself, which was that I had a competent, possible actor's voice, but I walked like a duck. I was too tall. I shambled across the stage, and I found myself playing a succession of the same roles. I always came on as the second policeman in Agatha Christie plays at the Salisbury Repertory Company, where I was working. And I was always the person who sort of walked in after the Country House murder and said, excuse me, Mum, what's this on the floor, indicating the body. And I sort of saw that this wasn't going to be really a very hot career. I could probably play second policeman for the rest of my life if I stayed on in the theatre.
And the rest of the time driving a cab.
And the rest of the time driving a cab. Well, I actually drove some cabs. I went back to the university to start graduate work. And I used to support myself in the evenings by cab driving in Hull, in northeast Yorkshire, which was then a very, very exciting city to be living in. It was a big fishing port. You could then walk across the fish dock from trawler to trawler to trawler to trawler to trawler. This was before the great Cod War with Iceland extending its fishing limit to 200 miles. The cod industry in Hull was huge. My job, basically, was to ferry Icelandic seamen who could speak about three words of English, one of which was woman, to prostitutes in the city. I became, you know, cab drivers are amazing experts at the inside of city lives. I mean, if you want to really find out about how a city works, you either ask a cab driver or a policeman, or you find yourself a tame crook.
Have a particularly loathsome cab driver in your novel Foreign Land, one of the most vile persons I'd ever run across in literature, and not unlike the cab drivers we have in New York.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if you're going to take exception to the cab driver in London who figures in Foreign Land, even just during the course of the day, of today, riding around Manhattan Island, I think I could beat his language.
Did you find a cab driver in New York who spoke English?
We are.
That's very difficult to find. Or no other way around, as far as that goes. Well, with the theater not working out for you, what did you decide to do?
Well, I started a PhD thesis, which was it had one of those kind of immensely elaborate PhD thesis titles, but it was basically about the Jewish novel of immigration to New York from Europe from 1870 to the present day. You know how they have to have dates. It was probably 1872 to the present day for no good reason at all, except for the fact that 1872 looks like a fancy date to put on a thesis. And it started with novels like The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahn, and worked through to novelists like Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and Bernard Malamud. Looking back on that now, I do see a connection between my own Christian parsonage upbringing and that sense of isolation that I was talking about, and passionate identification that I had when I was an adolescent with Jewish American heroes. It seemed to me that where the world was happening in literature was in the Jewish American novel. It was in figures like Joseph, the dangling man of dangling man in Saul Bellow's first novel. It was with Alexander Portnoy. It was the central character whose name I cut, Frank, in The Assistant by Bernard Malamud. These were wonderful outsider heroes of a kind who didn't really exist in English fiction, but who seemed to, somehow to me, reflect my own predicament, and I passionately identified with them. I wanted really, at one stage, to
that was your PhD
honorary,
thesis.
Honorary Jew.
That was your PhD thesis?
It was my uncompleted PhD thesis, because I managed to land myself a job teaching English in a university before I'd finished it, so I thankfully gave up the PhD thesis and turned to writing books.
Was the Lowell book your first?
No, it wasn't. Oh, I 20 years before I wrote my first novel, with characteristic 23-year-old arrogance, I wrote a book called The Technique of Modern Fiction, of which I'm now bitterly ashamed. Then I wrote a study of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, and then I wrote a book called The Society of the Poem, which was about contemporary poetry. Mm-hmm. And then I left university teaching and became a freelance writer and started to write other books and plays and short stories, and got away, thank God, from the business of the academic, which is to write books about books.
But Foreign Land is your first published novel.
Well, yes, you say that. In fact, Old Glory, which is the book that preceded it, which was based on, and I say based on advisedly, a trip which I made down the Mississippi from Minneapolis down to the Gulf of Mexico in a small open boat. That was essentially an autobiographical novel. It was structured like a novel. It was plotted like a novel. It handled character as a novel does. It handled dialogue as a novel does. And the first-person hero at the center of it was constructed as a character rather than simply as, you know, the reportorial eye. The difference between Old Glory and Foreign Land is not the difference between a work of non-fiction and a work of fiction. It's simply a shift of point of view. I got sick of the tyrannical effect of the first person in the travel narrative. Travel narratives essentially are a form of picaresque novel. In other words, you have a central character who moves through the world, has adventures, meets up with people, drops people, meets up with more people, drops them, and so on and so on and so on. You construct a character on page 191, and by page 193 you drop him behind because your boat has to go on somewhere down the river. And I got sick simply of the linear structure of that, of the I seeing the world through only one person's point of view, and also having to rather fictionally limit the experience of that first-person narrator to what was believable in the dust jacket biography of myself at the back. In other words, it did say Jonathan Raeburn was born in 1942, he is English, and so on. So the first-person character who goes through Old Glory and rides down that river has to be an Englishman of a certain age and a certain educational background, and so on. I was sick of being myself by the time I finished Old Glory. I wanted to change my sex. I wanted to change my age. I mean, this is what happens to one in middle age. So I wanted to see the world through the eyes, first of all, of a 60-year-old man, give or take roughly 20 years older than myself. I wanted to shift between his point of view and the point of view of two women, one aged 55, a once slightly famous pop singer, and a 37-year-old feminist journalist, and a much more optimistic character, a 23-year-old boy called Tom, who is able to survive in the underworld of South London as a sort of effective trader con man figure who makes things and barters things in the sort of black market economy which now exists on the underside of Mrs. Thatcher's England. And I wanted to take those four people and look at the world through their points of view, rather than limiting myself to this insistent, egotistic I, first person, of the travel narrative. But I don't see that Foreign Land is my first novel by any means. I think it is simply my fourth book.
Well, you're a prime character in Foreign Land, a 60-year-old George Gray, returns to England after 40 years in an African country. So I obviously assume that the title, Foreign Land, does not refer to the mythical African country that he has been in for so long, but actually to Mrs. Thatcher's England.
Oh, yes, I think the most foreign land, and this is something that every traveller, I think it's possibly what travellers designed to teach one, is that always the most foreign land is home. And that, I guess, is what the book is about.
On page 45, there was a wonderful and grim picture of London. This is when George is going through the city in the taxi cab. And it's been a number of years since I've been in London. And it was a little dirtier than I had expected, but a lot cleaner than New York City. I was surprised, in a way, to find you writing about London. In such a way, and making it sound so grim. Have things changed? Have things become so much worse than I recall?
Well, this is a work of fiction, and that passage is London seen through George's eyes. This is a man who has known London and a rather Knightsbridge-y world. In other words, the London of the upper middle class in the 1940s, and really hasn't been back there much since. This vision of London, which he has on, if you say it's 45, I'm sure it is 45, is South London. One of the whole points of that little journey that he takes by cab to visit his daughter is that he has never, ever gone to South London. He's never crossed over the river. I mean, it's like a New Yorker never having gone to Brooklyn. And what that passage registers is not my shock or any kind of journalistic report on the state of London now. It is George's shock as a man who has been away from home for 40 years, who knew London once but never went south of the river, as many middle-class Londoners didn't, and cannot believe in the reality of places like Brixton and Clapham, the southern suburbs on the far side of the river, which were socially nowhere in the world that he came from. So that it is his shock that's being registered. It's not my journalistic report on the state of London.
It may be his shock, but it certainly is a description that must be accurate when you see pictures. There's a picture of people gathered around the drum, the fire, getting warm around the drum. So, I mean, this is certainly an accurate picture of what it looks like, though. Even though George may be shocked by it, reality still exists.
Well, I think what I would say is that we have never seen England so violently polarized between the rich and the poor as we are seeing it now under Mrs. Thatcher's government. And I would say that there were clear parallels with what is happening in the United States, though I think in some ways the drama is greater in the United Kingdom at present than it is in the United States. And I do think that the plight of unemployed people in England now, set against the amazing, unparalleled richness of people like the real estate agents, who are the real profit makers out of Mrs. Thatcher's rather peculiar philosophies, the gap between those two groups is greater and fiercer than it has ever been before. And what one is seeing is a war of class confrontation, and that, I suppose, to some extent is reflected in George's appalled vision of England, that what he does see is classes pitted against each other, much as we saw them dramatically pitted against each other during the miners' strike of last year. Did you notice, by the way, I don't know how famous a figure in this country Arthur Scargill, the miners' leader, ever became. Does Arthur Scargill raise an image in your head?
I don't know very much about him. I know he was certainly involved in the strike, but I didn't follow
him. He was the miners' leader.
What
was most fascinating to me about the strike as an outside observer was the astonishing resemblance between Thatcher and Scargill. First of all, they both appeared to go to the same hairdresser. They both have that sort of wiry, sticking-up, blow-dried hair look about them. And they are ideologically very similar, too. They both speak in an absolutely, I will not be brooked, this is my position, I will not yield on a single point kind of way. They both come from rather similar methodistical, lower middle class in Mrs. Thatcher's terms, upper working class in Arthur Scargill's terms. They both come from well north of London. And what you were watching was the representatives of two now very separated classes, the middle class and the working class, facing each other across a great chasm of money, but fundamentally speaking in exactly the same language, in exactly the same way, and with an eerie physical resemblance to each other. And I don't know. I don't know that there is much, actually, of that in foreign land, but it's certainly something I feel very strongly about the country that I'm living in at present, myself.
Jonathan Raven, you refer to characterize foreign land as your fourth book rather than your first novel. What can we expect in the future? Just more books or more novels or more travel or what? Do you have anything outlined, any agenda for yourself?
Oh, yes, more books. But what we haven't talked about at all, which is what seems to me to be right at the center of foreign land, is the sea.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we might possibly get onto that, might
certainly,
have time.
Certainly. Are you indeed a sailor yourself? First you go down the Mississippi River and you describe that, and then here we have George in a ketch off the southern coast of England. So.
In 1979 I had nothing whatsoever to do with boats. I mean, I occasionally rented one on the River Thames and sculled it around. Then I took a little motorboat down the Mississippi. I lived out of that boat for 4 or 5 months, from Labor Day to New Year's. When I junked it in the boatyard in New Orleans, I washed my hands of it with such relief. I thought, I am never, ever going to spend one second of my time in a small boat again. By the time I got back to London, within 3 weeks, I felt so widowed without this boat that I had bought myself another one, an almost exact replica, which I had on the Thames. Within a year of that, I had a 32-foot seagoing ketch. And it is much, I think, like being a cocaine addict. I got more and more interested in the kinds of adventures that one could have on the water. And the way in which, particularly in England, which is a small, tight, overcrowded island, the only wilderness left is the wilderness of the sea, and the sea hasn't changed. The land has, beyond all recognition. I have a wonderful book, which I bought from an antiquarian booksellers in London, which is the first ever coasting guide to British waters. It was published in 1685, and it was by Captain Grenville Collins, who was commissioned by Charles II to make a total survey of the British coast. Now, I have his pilot book, and I've actually used it on board my boat, and you can still sail around the seas of Britain using Captain Grenville Collins's 1685 guide to soundings and headlands and basic landmarks like castles and churches and so on. Now imagine using a 17th century road map to find your way around the modern world. I mean, you'd be completely lost. I mean, it would be no good at all. But the sea is an unchanging element because it is a wilderness. The tides run to exactly the same rhythms. In fact, Grenville Collins's tide table at the beginning of his book is one that I quite often consult myself when I can't find a newspaper to tell me high tide at London Bridge and I want to find out. I can calculate on the Grenville Collins tide tables of 1685. They work very well, to within about 5 minutes. So I took to the sea in order, first of all, in order to get away from home and also to some extent come back to it. In 1982, I took this 32-foot boat and sailed it alone around the British Isles, which was a voyage of about 3,000 miles. And I went back to everywhere that I'd ever lived, everywhere that I'd worked in. I lived out of the boat. And one of the nice things about having a boat like that is that so long as you keep out of territorial waters, which is only 3 miles off the coast, you are effectively, so long as you're not flying a national ensign, and I do not fly a red ensign at the stern of my boat, you are effectively running a small, independent state of your own. Your boat, you know, is your own ship on the high seas, and you can run it as your own private republic. And mine is rather a literary republic. It's full of books, it's got a good writing table, it's got a decent flush lavatory and a kitchen big enough for my rather elementary style of cuisine, a comfortable double bedroom up front, and it is rather like, it's a cross between a floating thatched cottage and a republic on the water, really, the moment I get out of territorial waters. I had this sort of conceit in the literary sense in my head that it would be such fun to be able to sail away from Mrs. Thatcher's England in my ship and then look back at the ship that Mrs. Thatcher was running, as it were, across the water, and compare the way in which I ran my ship with the way that she runs hers.
Interesting way of putting
it. This, of course, is the germ of George's voyage, which is at the centre of foreign land. He takes foreign land is a work completely of fiction, with this one exception. One character in the book is drawn totally from life, and that is the boat.
Are you living on the boat on a full-time basis?
Oh, no, I'm not. Present is out of the water being refitted, but I shall take to it in April, I hope, when I finish the book that I'm working on now and sail away for 4 months. I want to go into the Baltic and explore around there.
I'm sure that's going to produce another book from Jonathan Raven, isn't it?
I'm going there with the explicit intention of not writing a book about it, but whether I should
so you say no.
Hold that promise, I don't know.
Well, Jonathan Raven, we're out of town, and we have been for a while, but certainly an engaging guy and easy to talk to. And you said a while ago that writing gives you the chance to think about things you wish you had been able to say but couldn't think of the right words previously, but you, in talking with you, it's obvious to me that you always come up with the right words. It's, I think the typewriter ink somehow is running through your veins and also makes it possible for you to speak in these literary ways. And it's certainly a pleasure to hear you talk. And I love the book, and I want to read more of your stuff, and I thank you very much for coming in and spending this time with me.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.